called Economics in 10 Lessons?
No, I never have.
It'd be a great book. I would urge you to get that. You can get it out of Laissez-Faire Books up in San Francisco. But he talks about like the 10 economic fallacies and talks about this idea of profit, discusses it in a whole chapter. You might be able to get some idea of why I'm saying what I'm saying if you read that.
Well, to me, what you're saying is that you're attempting to justify by various means the act of exploitation.
No. I'm against exploitation, but I'm saying there's a difference between profit and exploitation. And it seems like you and I are going back and forth on this. I don't know if either of us are doing a very good job of explaining our position right here, right now. But I think it's a very interesting topic because I think a lot of the economic confusion and chaos in this society actually kind of hinges over this question. So,
oh, by the way, I'm not anti-profit, and I'm not really even anti-exploitation, because I think they go hand in hand. But what I am anti is anti-ignorance. And I think that these issues, like we're talking about right now, which are rather enormous conceptual issues, are the kinds of issues that we ought to talk about without having short, snappy answers and hanging up.
Amen to that.
Tom, thank you very much.
All right.
All right, see ya.
Thank you. Well, I think it's that's certainly a crucial question. Can you have profit without exploitation? There is many instances, particularly in the kind of society as it's evolving right now, where a lot of profit is based upon exploitation. You have, think of Halliburton. They're over there in Iraq. They're going to reap enormous benefits, and your tax dollars at work. And I think there's enormous exploitation going on there that benefits the few at the expense of the many, i.e., the two of us, you and I, and we have to keep our eye on that. So I think this is an extremely crucial question. I think when I come back here next Monday, we can talk a little bit more about that. Because this whole argument that you have between so-called liberals and so-called conservatives often boils down to issues about money and what to do with it and what role government should have in the, quote, redistribution of wealth. I think of that issue in the Bible where the man runs up to Jesus and said, "Speak to my brother that he may divide the wealth with me." And he looks at him, "Well, who am I to say how your wealth should be divided?" So if Jesus himself did not see himself as a person to divide the wealth, well, where in the world do we think government should be doing that? And yet that seems to be a cornerstone philosophy of many people in government. So we'll take this issue up here next week. This has been Tom Clooney, and I'll see you next Monday. Thank you for listening.
Okay. All righty. So I'm going to the Bible.
Ongoing forever.
Somebody just doesn't believe in profits.
Well, you just said you cannot have profit without exploitation.
Mm-hmm. And, does he have a wife? Does he have any children? Does he have them do any work?
Mountain majesty.
Dan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and we'll be back here in just a moment. This is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and of course, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that will determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. We welcome your calls ordinarily at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for a few minutes. We have with us on the line Dr. Mark Geyer. We're going to be talking about a case study control of mercury burden in children with autistic spectrum disorders. And that sounds pretty fancy. What we're talking about is that some children are getting autism and other mental diseases is a direct result of the mercury that's been in vaccines, and neither the government nor the vaccine manufacturers want to admit that. Not only that, but of course, as we've talked about in the past, there seems to be a great deal of evidence that mercury is one of the primary causes of Alzheimer's disease in the elderly, and yet, of course, we're still giving toxic doses of that in the influenza vaccine. And, well, I'm going to let Dr. Geyer talk about it because he's on the front lines of this battle. Mark, thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Hi, glad you could have me.
Why don't you go ahead and just tell our listeners just a little bit about how you got involved in this and your interest in the subject.
I've been working with vaccines for about 25 years. I'm an MD and a PhD in genetics, and I worked at the National Institutes of Health in the 1970s and got involved with problems with vaccines and have been really working on it ever since. And it's only been in the last year or year and a half that I've been involved with the problems of mercury in vaccines. That was an area of vaccine that most people were not familiar with, including me. And in fact, when I was first approached about the idea that there was an autism epidemic and the amount of mercury in the vaccines went up, my initial reaction was, you know, so did the amount of cell phones. So cell phones caused autism. I didn't believe at all that the mercury was the cause of the autism epidemic. However, after a considerable amount of study and a tremendous amount of research on my part and many others, it's become fairly obvious that mercury plays a major role, the mercury in our vaccines plays a major role in the rather awful autism epidemic that we're currently having.
Well, let's talk a little bit about that autism epidemic. You know, certainly we found that, you know, in years past, I'd always thought there was maybe 1 in 10,000 children were autistic. You point out that it's but by the mid-1980s, it was 1 in about 2,500 children were autistic.
Well, actually, we've gone back to the 70s, and according to the government statistics in the middle 70s, you were right. It was about 1 in 25,000. And by the middle 80s, it was about 1 in 2,500.
And now, of course.
By the middle 90s, it was 1 in 250. And currently, it may be higher than 1 in 150.
And, of course, you're commenting, of course, it's about 5 times more common in boys. So certainly about 1 in every 100 male children, young people, are autistic. Is that a fair statement?
Yes, I think that's fair. And it's the tip of the iceberg. It's not just autism. It's neurodevelopmental disorders, so that, for example, from the 1980s to the 1990s, learning disorders went up 30-fold. And in fact, the number of children now in special education, and this is not my statistics, this is from the U.S. Department of Education, one in eight children approximately now are in special education. But in order to be in special ed, you have to be 6 years old. So the fear is what's happening in the last 6 years. And the preliminary evidence is that it's going to come out to be one in five. One in five children, when the next numbers come out.
That is certainly going to bankrupt the whole educational system, isn't it? Over and above the tragedy of having an autistic child or a child that just can't learn normally.
Well, I'm not worried about bankrupting the educational system. I'm worried about bankrupting the United States, because these kids grow up and they don't get better and they aren't going to be able to work. And so can you imagine that when these children grow up, one in five children may not be able to work? And who's going to take care of them? This is the time when, you know, the baby boomers are supposed to be retiring, and there aren't enough workers to take care of them to begin with. And now we're going to have one in five children. And also, you know, it went from one in eight to one in five. If the cause isn't changed, what makes you think it's not going to go to one in three?
Well, of course, now, haven't they pretty well taken the thimerosal out of the vaccines? At least this is what we're told. Is that true?
Well, I don't know if it's true. And the reason I don't know is that I testified before Congress, Burton's Committee on Government Oversight, or Government Reform, and after I got through testifying, they got someone up from the FDA who said, well, we don't know if what Dr. Geyer said is right. It might be, it might not be, but thimerosal has been out of the vaccines for a couple of years. We went home to the PDR, the Physician's Desk Reference, and we looked it up in the 2003 version, and it was still in about half the vaccines. So we go, what's going on here? So we called up and got the package insert. And again, it was in the, it's in the vaccine. So then we had a news reporter call up one of the companies. And they the news reporter said, Dr. Geyer said it's in the PDR. Is that right? He says, yep. Dr. Geyer says it's in the package insert. Is that right? Yep. How about in the product? And he says, well, what's in the package insert does not necessarily reflect what's in the shot. Well, you know, that's a felony. You can't intentionally mislabel what's in the vaccine. I mean, that's intentionally mislabeling an injectable as a felony. Now, I don't have any way of arresting this guy or stopping the companies, but the answer is, if I can't rely on what's in the package inserts, then how am I going to know what's in there? And the answer is, we're going to have to test it, and we're going to do it. But right now, that makes me wonder, I don't know whether it's out, but I do know that, for example, it was in last year's influenza. They don't make any claim that it was out of that. We also had Dr. Weldon, who's a congressman, write some letters for us for the FDA, and they've admitted, despite the fact that they said under oath, it's been out for years, they've admitted that it's been at least until the year 2002. So if it's out, it's out of only some of them, and it's only been out recently, and we're not sure it's out of any of them.
All right, fine. Now, what about the influenza vaccine? Now, my understanding was that although they were going to take it out of the childhood vaccines, they were going to leave it in for us old folks.
Well, that's an impossibility, because some of the childhood vaccines are given by splitting the dose of the adult ones. So it's really very difficult to do that. And also, thimerosal undoubtedly causes damage in adults as well as children. So I think they need to take it out of all the vaccines, and I think they better take it out of all the vaccines forthwith.
All right, fine. And of course, we know that, of course, the children and adults are getting a lot of mercury as a result of their fillings. So let's get right down to the study that you had done, this case-control study of mercury burden in children with autistic spectrum disorders. I thought this was really fascinating. Now, did you do that, or was that your son?
I did it with my son, who's supposed to be on the line. I think they're working on it. Is he on?
Yes, I think he is. Are you there? Is this Mark or David? Or? All right, fine. Well, you go ahead and speak up. Tell us, can you tell us a little bit about this case study of mercury burden in children with autism? Basically, you took a lot of children with autism, and you actually gave them some sort of a chelating agent, and then checked their mercury excretion and compared it with normal children?
Yeah, that is absolutely correct. What we did is we looked in 221 children pre-diagnosed with either autism or autistic spectrum disorders, and we compared their mercury level following chelation therapy with 18 normal controls. And we sent off to the laboratory their urine following 3 days of this chelation therapy, and we showed that autistics had about 6 times more mercury than normal. And we looked for other heavy metals such as cadmium and lead and found that they had similar levels between the autistics and the normals. So this offers very strong evidence that mercury is playing some kind of role in these autistic children, causing damage.
Well, do you think if they have a difficulty handling? In other words, that, for instance, every child who gets these toxic doses of mercury doesn't in the vaccines hasn't got autism. Do you see that some children are more sensitive? Do you think that some children can't handle the mercury as well, and that tends to deposit in the brains?
Absolutely, and I think that you'll hear the authorities say that the autism epidemic, those who are willing to admit there's an autism epidemic, will say that it's a genetic thing. And this is a totally misleading statement. There are no genetic epidemics. It's impossible. It's an oxymoron. Genetics doesn't change quickly. But what you can have is you can have genetic susceptibility. And what these children have is they don't eliminate mercury very well. And so if they go around not getting much mercury, they do fine. But if they get a lot of mercury, they have trouble, whereas a normal child eliminates mercury, and then they do fine. And we're not the only study. About 2 weeks ago, there was another study that came out that showed the same thing in a totally different way.
And this refers to Dr. Boyd Haley, who's from University of Kentucky. What he did was look in the hair of children that had autism, looked specifically actually in their first baby haircut, to see how much mercury they had versus normal control. And what he found is the autistics had 6 times less mercury than the normal control.
In other words, children with autism have a much lower level of mercury in their hair, and this is supposedly because the normal child can excrete it, and they can excrete it through the skin, or they can excrete it through the kidneys, or through the feces, or they can excrete it in the hair, whereas the autistic children can't excrete it, and it tends to pool, and presumably in the brain. Is this it?
That's right. And by the way, hair may sound like a very strange thing to look at, but actually it's a classical thing to look at, and forensic people look at hair for studying poisoning. So this is a standard way of doing it, and it exactly fits with what we've seen. And interestingly enough, there have been some articles by the FDA and the drug companies that have said, ha, you know, you guys are wrong. The more mercury that people put out, the smarter they are. And the less mercury they have, the dumber they are. And they're exactly right. They didn't understand the mechanism. Now that you understand the mechanism, you see they found the same thing. They just didn't understand the mechanism.
And actually, research has gone beyond just looking beyond the amount of mercury in these children. They've actually looked now molecularly in these children, and they found that these people that have problems with mercury have a specific genotype, referring to something called a genomic marker called ApoE. This is a special kind of protein that certain that people have, and it comes in multiple different types. There's a 2, ApoE2, ApoE3, and ApoE4. And these different types have different amino acids. And basically, the amino acids have differing abilities to bind heavy metals. ApoE4 being the worst at binding the heavy metals, and ApoE2 being the best. And they found those that have mercury neurotoxicity have the ApoE4, whereas normals have much more of ApoE2 and 3.
All right. Well, I think that the important thing is that we realize we just didn't see autism 30 years ago, and we didn't see anywhere near the degree of Alzheimer's disease, which is the other end of the spectrum, 25 or 30 years ago. And there's been, of course, a massive increase in both autism and of course, in Alzheimer's disease over this intervening years. And, of course, part of the problem with Alzheimer's disease is people are living longer and, of course, presumably getting more exposure to mercury during that time, not only in the environment but also through their fillings. But then, of course, we get to the children, and here's something that should have been, of course, changed a long time ago, because it's my understanding that there are over 5,000 articles talking about the danger of mercury toxicity in human beings. Is that true?
In fact, there are 5,000 articles talking about thimerosal.
Now, this is thimerosal, which is they put in the vaccines.
Yeah, they not only put it in the vaccines, but in past years they put it in all sorts of products that you may have been exposed to. I have when I was a kid, I remember that when we fell down and we got cut, they used to wipe the cut with
methylate, right?
No, first they did it with iodine.
Iodine, okay.
See, I'm real old, so I go way back.
Okay.
And iodine killed everything, but it burnt like crazy. So then they came out with mercurochrome, which is thimerosal or methylate, same stuff. And that looked red like iodine, but it didn't burn. So the kids loved it.
But, you know, you go to the drugstore to buy it now, and you know what you find? It isn't available anymore. It's been withdrawn many years ago because it caused many many children to be children and adults to get sick and many to die. There were people wiping on umbilical cords, you know, to keep the cord sterile after the baby was born. A number of those babies died. So we've known about it. That's an example of one of the 5,000 types of studies that were done that showed that this stuff is really bad, and yet we keep giving it to our children and adults and vaccines. And this is absolutely unacceptable. And, in fact, the FDA, although they try to sort of deny it, is well aware of it.
Well, now, my understanding is that there's only one or two studies that suggest that this is safe, and those were actually financed by Eli Lilly. Is that true?
There's only one study that I've ever seen. It was done in 1930, and it was not only financed by Eli Lilly, who owns the patent on thimerosal, but it wasn't about safety really at all. They were trying to treat people that had a brain infection with thimerosal, and almost all the people died, and their only safety is there was a comment that it didn't seem to make these people who were dying anyway any worse. That's their idea of safety. And they've grandfathered in the sense that because it's been in vaccines a long time, they're no longer required to show that it's safe. But there really isn't any safe. There's 5,000 articles on one side, not to mention the stuff that we talked about. Those 5,000 articles predate our working on the vaccines. And there's one article on the other side which really doesn't even say what they said it says.
Isn't Eli Lilly actually liable then, once, of course, all of this material is there in the literature, and we see this just epidemic. I mean, and as you point out, you know, autistic children are a terrible, terrible burden for the family, and a tragedy for the child, tragedy for the parent. And yet, of course, the government, you know, in its wisdom, a few years ago, mandated every child in the nursery be given almost forcibly a hepatitis B shot just loaded with mercury.
Well, let me make one thing clear. We're not anti-vaccine. We believe that vaccines have done wonderful things like eliminate polio, eliminate whooping cough. We're not anti-vaccine. We're just in favor of making the vaccines used rationally, used as safe as possible, and also that they be controlled and decisions be made on them by people who don't have a vested interest.
Well, of course, my concern about the hepatitis B vaccine is I don't think there's any possible use for giving it to children in the United States. I can see why they may want to give it routinely to children in other countries like China, or, you know, where they have such a massive incidence of it. But giving it to children here in the United States, I just don't think that justifies. And, you know, I have nothing against the vaccines, and I recognize, as you do, they've done wonderful things. But we're doing more harm than good. Then, of course, we've got to do something to stop it.
On the hepatitis B, my view is that if the mother is hepatitis B positive and infectious, maybe you could give the vaccine. I believe that's about 1 in 1,000 mothers here.
Right,
I believe also that virtually every hospital that delivers a pregnant woman has checked her hepatitis B, not because they're so worried about her having it for the baby, but because no laboratory person or medical person will go near them without knowledge of that because it's infectious. So my view is that they should only give that shot to the 1 in 1,000 or whatever it is that, where the mother is positive.
And I certainly agree with that. But anyway,
however, there is a use for hepatitis B vaccine. It's probably well used in, you know, 18-year-olds who are going to be high-risk people, but not in newborns.
Amen to that. Well, I think that we maybe ought to wait until they really are going to be in a position where they're going to contract the disease. And then, of course, maybe we ought to try to counsel these young people to act responsibly. I know that's a hard thing to do, but, you know, giving it to all these children, especially with the disastrous effects of the thimerosal, is another question. We're going to be back in just a minute with Mark and David Geyer, and we're going to, of course, invite your calls here at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295, because this is a vitally, vitally important subject. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest is Mark and David Geyer, Dr. Mark Geyer, with a MD and PhD, and of course David is has his BA, and he works with his father on many of these fascinating studies of really trying to document from a scientific point of view the fact that there is a definite relationship between autism and mercury. And of course, the implications of this, of course, I'm sure are really shaking the very foundations of the public health officials, you know, who have been recommending these, of course, vaccines as routinely. You know, if you don't want to give them, you're one of those right-wing quack, believe in a black helicopter a group. And now suddenly, as the scientific evidence comes out, it's very hard to admit, well, gee, maybe we've been wrong. Now, nothing wrong with the vaccine, but the way it's produced, and if it's producing more harm than good, why, certainly we're going to have to reevaluate that. And of course, the question comes up, how many children would die, you know, as a result of not having the vaccines? How many would, of course, become autistic as a result of taking the vaccines? When you're talking about one in every 100 children being autistic, that is indeed a frightening figure.
We've actually tried to calculate the economic damage by this mistake, and I believe it's an iatrogenic mistake. That means a doctor caused a mistake, and in fact, the FDA has memos that say, quote, we were asleep at the switch. And so we've tried to calculate the damage to the United States, and I'll let David tell you how he did it, but the most conservative estimate that we've come up with is the damage done by this is $2 trillion. That's not with a B, that's with a T, dollars.
All right, David, why don't you give us the background on that?
What we've done to sort of look at this issue is we simply looked at the U.S. Department of Education, which has very good statistics on children that have autism. They give children of each age group in the U.S. Department of Education that have autism. And so we looked for a whole generation of children in the U.S. Department of Education. And we assigned a sort of a conservative amount, about $10 million for lifetime cost for each autistic child. And so we just did the math, and you add it together for a whole generation, and we found that the amount is approaching $2 trillion. That's just looking at children that have autism that are in U.S. public schools. So that's a very conservative kind of estimate.
Well,
you know who's going to pay it.
Now, are we seeing a rise in autism in third world countries, or perhaps in Europe, where they are using vaccines? Are they using thimerosal over there?
The worst place is England. England is not only using thimerosal, but they've announced they have no intention of changing, and they also use wholesale DPT, which is the old version that we finally got rid of in the United States, and they have a worse vaccine schedule, at least for the purpose of adverse effects. We vaccinate our children with DPT and the other vaccines at 2, 4, and 6 months of age. And they vaccinate them at 2, 3, and 4 months. Probably would work fine for protection. But as far as exposure, this is much worse. And we've heard now that their autism rate may be as high as 1 in 69.
1 in 69 children. Well, that is just a catastrophe. Well, is anybody over there concerned, or are they simply playing this game? Well, of course, you know, you can trust us because we're from the government and we would never lie to you.
The government is playing the game, but there is a very large lawsuit ongoing involving MMR vaccine and autism and some other issues, and there are parents groups that are up in arms, and it's the usual thing. The authorities are saying it isn't happening, but I think it's gotten so big, just like it is in the United States, that saying it isn't happening isn't going to cut it anymore. This is too big a thing to hide under the rug.
Well, now, of course, for a time, there was a great deal of talk that it was the live vaccine in the MMR that was the measles component of that, which, you know, was alive, and somehow this was related to colitis. And, you know, a lot of these children would have not only their autism, they'd have a severe diarrhea going along with that. Did you hear that story?
We've not only heard it, we've published on it and studied it, and we think it's accurate. And we think that it may have accounted for a good deal of the rise between the late 70s and early 80s, and that it accounts for some of the current autism. This is primarily the work of Dr. Andy Wakefield.
Right.
And we've published on it, and we agree, but I think both he and we agree that that's not the major cause. That might be, you know, 10 or 20% of what's going on now, but the mercury is the large cause, and in fact, the mercury may be necessary for the viruses to cause the damage. But there's no question that a number of these children have GI symptoms as well. And Dr. Wakefield has, in certain children, isolated vaccine-strain measles from the GI system in autistics.
Well, now, what happened to Dr. Wakefield? Because he came under tremendous, tremendous pressure because he dared to suggest that there was something wrong with vaccines. And, of course, when you are in a country where, of course, every aspect of medicine is controlled by the government, and the government comes down on you, why, you're in real trouble. I understood he had lost his position in one of the hospitals over there. Is that true?
He had a very big position over there, actually.
He was in charge of gastroenterology at the Royal Free College of Medicine in London.
So what actually happened to him then?
He published his famous work that really did him in was he published a paper called Through a Glass Darkly, which is a paper on MMR vaccine where he talked about that maybe there weren't the original clinical trials with MMR vaccine didn't fully address the safety issues of MMR vaccine. And he published that paper in a journal. And when it was published, it had the unprecedented thing of not only did his work appear, but the peer reviewers' comments actually accompanied the article. And the peer reviewers were from various governmental agencies in the UK. And each of them basically agreed with the conclusions that Andy Wakefield drew in his paper. And after that article was published, Andy Wakefield was fired from his position at Royal Free and actually immigrated to the United States. And the journal he published in, which was published by Oxford University Press, within several months was sold and is no longer, I think, in print.
So they got rid of the journal as well as Andy Wakefield, but Andy Wakefield's still around and still doing these kinds of studies, and they're still very frightened of him. We had a meeting with him in Detroit, and after that meeting he was going to go look in children to see if he could find the MMR vaccine in their spinal fluid, which would really be, this would be vaccine strain in the spinal fluid. So he went to the local state hospital, and he tried to draw the fluids. He brought a pediatric expert, and the British got a court order to stop him from drawing it at our state hospital.
The British got an order to stop it from being drawn here in the United States?
Here in the United States. So he at a state hospital. They didn't want to be involved. So he went to a private hospital, and he drew them. And he put his little pediatrician, nice little guy, on the plane to take it back to England. The plane pulled out on the tarmac, and it was surrounded by the FBI. The guy was taken off the plane, arrested, and they said he had illegal specimens. They held a 3-day hearing, at which time they found out, of course, that he had full permission, and they apologized to him, and they said he could take his specimens, they put him back on the plane, and he flew from the United States to Scotland, where the plane landed and was surrounded by their FBI, who took him off the plane, had another 3-day hearing, because they said he had illegal specimens, and again it was found that they were legal, and now he's doing testing on them, and it hasn't been published yet, but he's finding it. He's finding the virus in the brain.
Now he's finding, so in other words, some of these are related to the virus. And is this the measles virus, the rubella virus, the mumps virus, or
it's the measles virus?
It's the measles virus.
And actually, there's even more work than Andy Wakefield. There's a gentleman named Dr. Singh from Utah University, where he's looked in autistics in their sera. And he's found that some of them have an unusual antibody response to the measles component of MMR vaccine. And this antibody response is cross-reactive with myelin basic protein. This is something found in the nervous system, the central nervous system.
Is this sort of a molecular mimicking affair then?
Yeah, molecular mimicry, that's correct.
Yes.
Could you explain that for our listeners? Because I think that's such an important concept. And because remember, the majority of our listeners are lay people, but molecular mimicking really, of course, explains why. Well, we're going to have to wait till we get back. But if you wouldn't mind just picking that up when we go on. And what this really means is that many of the people who get the vaccines develop an immune system, an immunity to their own tissues. And of course, if this is something in the myelin sheath, why it means that they are going to be dissolved their own myelin sheaths. Anyway, we'll get talking about that and so many other things. We'll welcome your call at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Give us a call if you have a question or comment, because this is a vitally important subject. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and our guest this evening is Mark and David Geyer. Father and son team are out there on the front lines, really trying to solve this puzzle that has led to so many tragic results, so many tragic family disasters. And, you know, of course, when we talked off the air, Mark, you were just saying what a personal disaster it is for a family to have an autistic children. Could you explain what, first of all, let's talk about molecular mimicking, and then I'd like you to tell our listeners, you know, about the tragedy of an autistic child and what it really means to a family.
Well, a molecular mimicry means that you're presented with an antigen and you make an antibody. This is how we make immunity to diseases. But unfortunately, sometimes when you make antibodies to the disease looks enough like yourself that the antibody that you make to the disease attacks you. And there are a number of company officials that are denying that this mechanism actually works, which is ridiculous because there's a well-known model disease, and that's rheumatic heart disease. When a child gets strep throat, there's a risk that the child will develop rheumatic heart disease. And this is not because the strep, the bacteria in his throat, goes to the heart. It's because the strep has an antigen that looks like heart tissue. And when you make antibody to the heart tissue, you also get, that may attack your heart. When you make antibody to the strep, the antibody may attack your heart. And this is a classic disease. And interestingly, in the 50s, there were a whole lot of people that had rheumatic heart disease. In fact, my grandmother died of rheumatic heart disease. And the interesting thing is that now, of course, when you have strep throat, they give you penicillin. But the real reason that rheumatic heart disease has gone away is the strep strain has changed enough so that it no longer looks very much like the heart. But anybody who denies that molecular mimicry exists forgot this disease, because no one would dispute that that disease works the way I just said.
And then you get glomerulonephritis with that as well?
Yes, there's another strep strain that looks like kidney. In fact, my uncle died of that one. I guess my family has a susceptibility to this. And so what happens on that strep strain is that, and that was less common than rheumatic heart disease. Again, you make antibodies to that strep in your throat, and that antibody attacks your kidney.
Okay.
That's molecular mimicry, and the same kind of thing can happen with vaccines, especially if they have impurities that look a lot like your brain. And that's what's happening in some of these disorders.
All right, well, tell us a little bit about what autism is, because, you know, even though I'm a physician, you know, I was really relatively uninformed about what autism was and what happened to the child, you know, with this, because when I went to medical school, they never described autism. I graduated from medical school in 1952. I'd never heard of autism until maybe 10 years or so ago.
That's because it was so rare in those days that most people hadn't seen it. In addition, it was different. It's kind of a shame that we have two diseases that look very different that are called autism. Excuse me. And the current disease that we're seeing so much of actually is probably better called regressive autism. In the early days, like you know, when you and I went to medical school a long time ago, there were very few autistics, and the few autistics that there were, if you talk to the mother, she would say, "Well, I got four kids. When I took this kid home, I knew there was something different about him. I mean, from the day I got him, I knew he was different." Now that's not the story you hear at all. Now the story is the kid was perfectly normal at birth, was fine at 1 year old, was walking, was beginning to talk, was doing all the developmental milestones, and then in the second year of life, they went downhill, they crashed, and they become an absolutely terrible child. These children are not like the movie where the person just doesn't speak very well and is pretty smart. These kids are a tremendous behavior problem, many of them. They tear down the walls. Over half of them will never speak. Most of these kids will never be able to work. And so although I have great sympathy for the families, I'm very frightened. I'm frightened for this country that I love. And that is, this is not a threat just as a tragedy to the individual children. This is a threat to the very existence of the United States as a leading nation. We can't walk around with a tremendous number of our children growing up being 6'3", uncontrollable. We're going to have to take care of them until they're 70 or 80 years old and not contributing to the workforce. This is going to cause major problems. This is a major threat to our society, and it's one that people are not very aware of. If you talk to the common person on the street, yeah, they seem to have more autism. And yeah, we don't know any adult autistics. Isn't that strange? There's so many children autistics. There are no adult autistics because it's just happening now. But I'm afraid, I'm very fearful, not only for these families. I'm fearful for our society. I think we got
major problems. If one in five children, when the statistics come out, are in special ed, most of those kids, when they get to be older, are going to have to be taken care of, and they can't contribute to the workforce. At the same time, when our baby boomers like me and you are retiring, we're going to have great trouble keeping this country being a modern, leading nation. And that's even more troubling to me than the individual suffering.
And, Christian, these children will automatically go on to Social Security at a very young age and just drain off, of course, the remaining money that isn't there and has to be, of course, there is no Social Security fund. So it's, dollar in, dollar out, and they hope that they have more dollars in than dollars out. But, of course, that will not be very much longer because the dollars that come in, we immediately spend on some other government program if they aren't already being given to the people. Now, as far as the children's cognitive ability, what about their intelligence? Are they intelligent, or many of them really have diminished intelligence?
They have diminished intelligence. These children are brain damaged. They're specific. They have usually more damage in the area of language. But just even being unable to speak, even if you had normal intelligence, you're not going to have normal development. These kids are not just a little unusual. There's an article, I understand, coming out tomorrow in Newsweek that's going to say that these kids are just, a little bit odd kids, and they're nice kids, and they're wonderful to have, and that, just take care of them and don't worry about it. These kids are, we meet with and talk to the Autistic Society parents. These kids are impossible to deal with. They're not going to go out and get jobs. The fact that they can show you, one in 100 that actually, has some ability and has managed to do something doesn't change the fact that the majority of these children are not only not going to be able to contribute to the workforce, they're going to need institutionalized care for the rest of their lives, and they're going to live normal lives. They're not going to, some people get sick and they die. That's a shame. These kids are going to live full lives. We're going to have to not only are they not going to contribute, we're going to have to take care of them as a society until they're 70 or 80 years old. And this is going
to
be...
And to give you an idea about the care, I've seen many of these children, you need multiple full-grown adults to take care of an adult autistic, one of these that's 6'3" and weighs 200 pounds. You need people to hold them down because they act uncontrollably. You need pads because they fall down because of their loss of balance and they get upset. I mean, it's going to take 5, 6, 7 people for each autistic child when they become an adult. It's just horrifying to think about.
Now, what you're basically saying is we're seeing literally an explosion of this, and we may very well, of course, have, even as a result of giving it up until a year or so ago, millions more children coming down with this terrible disease.
And we think we're giving it now. We have labeled vaccines that are labeled to still have an aerosol in them, and also, excuse me if I don't trust the drug companies, after they've admitted they mislabeled things, to tell us whether the thimerosal is in or out. And I've written with Dr. Weldon, a congressman from Florida, to the FDA saying, why don't you make this really clean? Why don't you say that as of, tomorrow, we won't allow this anymore? And they refuse to do that. They're going to allow them to, if they take it out, fine. If they want to put it back in, that's fine. They're not going to force them to have no thimerosal in their product.
All right, fine. Well, Chris, what about the possibility of lawsuits? Because I hate to say it, but sometimes the only way you can get companies and corporations to act responsibly is with the threat of lawsuits. And we saw that with tobacco when the government really wouldn't do anything other than put a little notice on the cigarette packages that cigarettes are harmful to your health, which, of course, gave the cigarette companies an out. They said, well, of course, you knew it was harmful. Look, it says though right there in small print. And it wasn't until the lawyers came along, and whatever their motivation, I would like to think that some of them were in this idealistically. I suspect most of them were in it for profit. But be that as it may, at least, of course, they put pressure on the tobacco companies, and it has cut back somewhat on this this lethal habit, addicting habit of so many Americans, which has resulted in so much cancer and suffering and death. So what about lawsuits as far as thimerosal is concerned and making them stop like yesterday?
I think the lawsuits are going to come. They think the lawsuits are going to come, and they've done everything possible to stop the lawsuits from coming. First, they put a rider on the Homeland Security bill, which forbid people from suing Eli Lilly.
How could they do that retrospectively, though? You might be able to say,
Well, they didn't get away with it.
You know, in the future, but what about for past actions? See, that would be, that's an ex post facto law.
Yeah, well, first of all, they didn't get away with it. But let me explain the logic of how they managed to do this. They did it at the 11th hour. It was sponsored by Frisk in the Senate. And the logic was that if we go around suing our vaccine manufacturers, who's going to make us vaccine? And not only that, they're not going to make vaccine for anti-terrorist purposes. Well, let me tell you what's wrong with that logic. Eli Lilly isn't a vaccine producer.
Right.
They haven't made vaccines since 1975. The last one they made was Trisulgin. So even that logic doesn't hold. And that law was overturned. However, there are still major roadblocks to lawsuits. The United States has something called the Vaccine Compensation Act. And that requires that people who think they're damaged by a vaccine go to the U.S. Court of Claims, to this act, and apply for compensation. Now, if you don't get compensation, or if you don't like what you get, you can turn it down, and then you can go to civil lawsuits. Congress passed this in 1989 at the GAN, and it sounded quite reasonable. It sounded like a way to get people to get money without having to be litigious, and, you know, it would be a simple hearing and that kind of thing. It's turned out to be a nightmare because, for example, the Vaccine Compensation Act requires that you apply within 3 years of the damage. And as you mentioned, they're going to claim the damage was that first shot that was given on the day of birth. And many of these children don't know they have autism until after 3 years of age. And in fact, they didn't even know the connection until recently. So you would think, well, I guess they can't go to the Vaccine Compensation Act, but they can go to civil court because in most states, if it's damage to a minor, you get to wait until you can sue up until age 18, and then you get your 3 years on top of that. Varies from state to state, but that's typical. So typically, for damage to a child, you get to age 21. Well, they're trying to claim that if you didn't go to the act, even though you can turn it down, if you didn't go, you lost your civil litigation rights as well. And in addition, if you go to the act is currently frozen. If you claim a thimerosal damage, they put you in the act. They freeze the time, but there's been no judgments, and they won't even consider it until next May. It was frozen for 2 years. They just accumulated them. And I have no idea what they're going to do about it, because the Vaccine Compensation Act has a fund now that sits at $2 billion. That's with a B. And that fund, incidentally, doesn't belong to the U.S. government. It belongs to the children. The act was set up with $600 million of yours and my money, that is taxpayers' money. But after that was in 89, after that, it was funded by a tax on vaccines. That means every child that got a vaccine, a couple of dollars, a dollar and a half, it varies from time to time, went into this fund. And now they've been giving out some money for various damages, but not by Marisol. And now they have $2 billion. So they're sitting pretty, and they can pay for vaccine damage, except for Thimerosal, because there's so many people coming. And as David pointed out to you, our calculation is $2 trillion. $2 billion isn't going to go very far. So I don't know what exactly is going to happen, but right now, there are no existing lawsuits that have status in state courts. All the states have said, go to the act and see what happens, come back to us. But right now, there are no existing lawsuits, and they're deflecting that course of action that you suggested, even though I think they're not going to be able to deflect it indefinitely.
Well, now I understood that they were talking about some class action lawsuits. In other words, that just the whole class of people would bring a lawsuit rather than individually.
They would try to block that with the Vaccine Compensation Act. However, there is another way, which is many states are considering, and I've met with a number of states' attorney generals, and that is, you remember how the tobacco litigation was done? That the individual suits, a person smoked and developed lung cancer and sued, there was very little success with that. However, the successful lawsuits actually were state governments were suing the tobacco companies for damage that the state had absorbed in taking care of the children and taking care of the adults. And the same thing is happening here. Many of these children end up in, state health departments and also state departments of education. And so a very good way to get around the current roadblocks is to have the states do it, because the states are not under the Vaccine Compensation Act. They could never have gone there. They don't have to go there. They're not under the statute of limitations. And so a number of them are considering suing. And this would actually be a much better suit than the tobacco litigation, because with the tobacco litigation, you can take the position that, like you said, that after all, these people should have known. They were adults. They made the decision. These kids had no choice. They did nothing wrong. They didn't choose to abuse tobacco. They did exactly what our society ordered them to do. And now they've been damaged, and nobody could have
proposed the idea that, they should recover, in my view, that they should recover damages that occurred to them because a vaccine was inappropriately made.
Well, now, have you heard the story, and I know I've heard this from parents, you know, my child was just doing great, meeting all the, normal stages of development until they had their shot, and they began to cry right after that, and, you know, the next day they were fussy, and, you know, after that, it was just all downhill. And so many of the parents will attribute, you know, the problem directly to, and they can even remember literally the day that shot was given.
I hear that story all the time. Unfortunately, that's the exact story that we hear, and that's the regressive autism. It's so different than the story that we heard, you know, 30 years ago when the child had the problem at birth.
So, you know, of course, it's a great, great tragedy for the, you know, and of course, one or two now, children do sometimes you get more than one in a family?
We have a family that the mother is very active in this that has three children. And I mean, their lives and their neighbors' lives and their whole family is totally destroyed. I mean, they have no possibility of a normal life. And in fact, the parents live in dread of the day when they can't take care of these children. And these children will then have to go to an institution and, you know, have very poor care.
Well, now, of course, do you feel that some of the cases of attention deficit disorder or attention deficit hyperactivity disorder fit into this?
Absolutely. And beyond that, I'm not sure you even have to have that kind of thing. I think just lowering of IQ. We have this really threatening thing, which is that we've all heard that the SATs, you know, the main test to get into college,
right,
has been lowered three times in the last 10 years. And, you know, that's supposed to be due to bad educational system. I don't think so. We also hear that now there are more girls in college than boys. That's supposed to be because women have more opportunity than they used to have. I don't think so. I think that what's happening is that we're damaging, especially the males, and we're damaging some of them very badly, and they become severe autistics. Some of them become mild autistics. Some of them become ADD. Some of them become just slightly brain damaged. I think that we're causing massive damage to our whole society.
Well, what is Asperger's disease? Am I pronouncing it right?
Yeah, that's a very mild form of that. There's a whole spectrum of disorders, from severe autism to mild autism to Asperger's, to someone that may be diagnosed as normal, but they only have an IQ of 80, but they should have had an IQ of 110. We had an interesting story, by the way. This is not limited to children. This goes with adults. There's a case that we were in, actually there are two cases, or three cases like this, where an adult was given a hepatitis B vaccine. Usually these are adults that are very high-performing adults. This guy was made like $1 million a year. He was a big stock, head of a big stock company, and, you know, he traveled around, and they gave him hepatitis B vaccine. Within a few days, he got sick. He started bumping into the walls. He couldn't keep his balance. He had headaches. He started out with an IQ of more than 160. He ended up with an IQ of 116. His memory was completely destroyed, and he could no longer do his job. And interesting, when they had the hearing, HHS, the government's position was, well, gee, you know, he's still above average in IQ, you know, and all right, he can't do his old job, but, you know, he can work at McDonald's now. What's the damage? Well, the answer is, to our society, a lot of damage. We've damaged somebody who was very smart and made them, you know, subpar, and that's what's happening, I think, to a lot of children who don't even bear, you know, a name of a part of autism. They've just been damaged. And you know that the reason that males, the probable reason that males are affected five times as much to, in some studies, 15 times as much, is that if you give mercury to neurons in a tissue culture, a very small amount of mercury will damage the neurons. These are cells from the nervous system. If you add testosterone, you make the damage much, much worse. And if you add estrogen, you make the damage much, much less.
And that's a fascinating thing. And this has already been done histologically?
Yes, this has been done by several groups, in fact. In fact, there's a movie that's shown that illustrates that you can actually watch the neurons die.
And is that Christy Diamond's video?
Yeah, I believe that's correct.
In fact, we actually carry that for our listeners out there. It's called Uninformed Consent. That's Uninformed Consent, and it's available through Radio Liberty. Just give us a call at 1-800-544-8927, 1-800-5-HIV-WARREN. It's talking about mercury and its disastrous effects, predominantly talking about the mercury that we're getting out of our fillings. pardon me, but Certainly mercury is mercury. This is one of the most toxic substances known to man. That's why they've outlawed thermometers, mercury thermometers. I grew up with mercury thermometers, and mercury is sphygmomanometers to check blood pressure. And now, of course, the government realizes how toxic this is, and yet, of course, they're still putting it in the vaccines that we're giving to our children and recommending that it be given in the nursery. Have they gotten away from that yet? Are they still giving the hepatitis B vaccine in the nursery? Or is they really, do we know whether or not the thimerosal is out of that being given on the first couple of days of life?
They are giving it on the day of life, and David will answer about whether it's in or not. The initial recommendation to remove thimerosal from all childhood vaccines began in 1999. That was made by American Academy of Pediatrics and U.S. Public Health Service. And then in 2001, the Institute of Medicine, the United States National Academy of Sciences, also agreed with that position. So in theory, all of the pediatric hepatitis B vaccines are supposed to be thimerosal-free. But again, looking at this 2003 Physician's Desk reference, Merck makes a hepatitis B vaccine for children, at least according to this reference book. Still contains thimerosal. In addition, they also make adult hepatitis B vaccine that contains thimerosal. And of course, the difference between the adult and pediatric hepatitis B vaccines is the pediatric one is simply two adult vaccines. So many doctors out there, in order to have a vaccine that you can both give to adults and children, buy the adult formulation and cut it in half. So there is still a very significant possibility that children may be receiving mercury at birth from their hepatitis.
Well, now, but does the adult vaccine still have the thimerosal in it?
Yes, that's correct. This policy, or these policies statements that I recited, they're only applying to routine childhood immunization. That means that if you look at the immunization schedule, these are the ones that are absolutely required. So that something like influenza vaccine, while recommended for most children, they would claim, even though it still contains thimerosal, it doesn't apply to the routinely recommended vaccine.
Well, this is madness, because here is a toxic substance. Why would you even consider giving it at all when you know, of course, that some children will overreact to this and it can destroy their lives? And, of course, the other thing that really concerns me is I suspect that even when they did order the thimerosal taken out, they allowed them to use up their existing stocks. Does anybody know whether that happened?
Yeah, they admitted that that happened.
Yeah, that absolutely happened. These recommendations simply say, or simply ask the companies to gradually change over. There was never any recall made of thimerosal-containing vaccines.
And by the way, I have a comment as to why. You might think, why would they, why do they make a big deal? After all, they make the vaccine, they add a drop of thimerosal, they put it in the vial, so they leave out the drop of vaccine of thimerosal. What's the big deal, right? Well, the story they give you is that thimerosal has been added to vaccines because it's necessary as a preservative in multi-dose vials. And if the doctor or the nurse is not careful when they withdraw a dose, they might contaminate the vial, and the next child might get bacteria. That's the stock answer. But that isn't really what's going on.
All right. What is going on?
They're not using it as a preservative. They're using it as a sterilizing agent. And that may seem like a small difference until you start thinking about it. What it means is they grow these vaccines non-sterily in a cheap way. It's expensive to have a sterile factory, sterile techniques, sterile pipettes, sterile hoods, all that kind of stuff. They make it cheap and non-sterile. They throw in a bunch of thimerosal in order to sterilize it. And then, by the way, they take some out because that's more than you could possibly tolerate. And so if they didn't have thimerosal, they might not be able to make the vaccine. You see, for example, Lederle Lab, when asked to remove thimerosal, dropped out of the vaccine business. This bothered me. I didn't understand why. Why would anybody do that? And the answer is, to do it right, you'd have to tear down your factory, build a new factory, and get new people. They've been lying to us about how they're using it. And this answers all my questions that I've had for the last year, like, why is thimerosal in Rogam, a product given to pregnant women, which never came in multi-dose vials? The answer is, again, they weren't sure it was sterile. Why does FDA refuse to make a law against thimerosal? They say because thimerosal will definitely be needed in third-world countries. Why do you need thimerosal in third-world countries? Well, they don't have good refrigeration. Well, that means the vaccine could fall apart, but thimerosal doesn't help on that. What it really means is the vaccines aren't totally sterile, and if they don't refrigerate them, they'll grow up. This answers all the questions. Another question I had was, if you look up MMR vaccine, it's available multi-dose vials, and there's no preservative. So first you tell me you have to have a preservative, then you don't. Well, the real answer is they're not using it as a preservative. They're using it as a sterilizing agent, and they're doing it because they don't want to make the vaccines in a safe way, which is sterile to begin with. And because of that, even if you sterilize it, you'll end up with all kinds of products, like endotoxins, leftovers from what the bacteria that used to be in there that were killed. And that's why our vaccines are as reactogenic as they are, because at one time, they contained bacteria. And they may contain bacteria even at the end, now.
In addition, there are also many of the vaccines where they removed the thimerosal, they didn't totally remove it. What they left was a trace amount. And they say, if you read these package inserts, the trace amount is left over from the manufacturing procedures. And the manufacturing procedures are exactly what my father just described, that they're using massive amounts to sterilize, followed by removal down to a trace amount.
Well, now, have they actually admitted this to you? I mean, how do you know that this is actually what they're doing, and why are they doing it? Is this conjecture, or has somebody actually come forward and admitted what's really going on?
They basically admitted it. They've admitted that it's used in the manufacturing process, not just as a sterilizing agent. And that's what I'm saying. It's a manufacturing process for sterilization. And by the way, it's a very poor choice. There are lots of better sterilizing agents.
Well, then why don't they use those as something that would be safer, you know, because it's obvious that this is a disaster. And, you know, there's just, I mean, we've destroyed so many lives with it.
The reason that they don't quickly switch, and there are some companies that have switched, another agent, is that thimerosal grandfathers, because it goes back so far, they have a rule that if a substance was used before a certain year, you don't have to prove it's safe. And if you added a new substance, you might well have to prove that it was safe. And you probably could do that, but it's a lot of extra time and extra money. And I think that eventually they probably will do it, but if they're not going to label the package correctly, and they're not going to make it illegal to put it in, then they could slip this stuff in and out without our even knowing about it. And maybe they want to do that because there's a risk to them. If they removed it all suddenly, and if the autism epidemic suddenly stopped, they'd have a lot of trouble denying it. So if they throw it in and out and they make it hard for you to tell when they remove it, it's still going to drop. I believe the autism rate will drop about in the year 2007, something like that, when the kids that are now getting, or hopefully will get, no thimerosal in their vaccines, it will drop. But I think they're afraid they're going to convict themselves. And what they're convicting themselves of is, you know, something absolutely terrible. $2 trillion worth of damage, not to mention that there may be even criminal problems. The Congress is investigating for criminal problems because some of the FDA people are taking drug company money and they're making these decisions, and they're not making very good decisions. And, you know, you have to start considering that maybe if someone's taking money from somebody they're supposed to be regulating and they're not making good decisions, maybe they're being influenced by the money.
I'm sure they really are. Well we're going to have to ask you to hang on. I just want to bid good night to our listeners up in the Great Northwest, and first to remind all of you who are listening tonight, this Labor Day, that Radio Liberty is listener-supported, and we're really dependent on those of you who listen to our programs and believe in what we're doing to help us so we can continue expanding and getting the information out across America, information you're not going to get through regular channels. So if you'd like to join the Radio Liberty family or even get perhaps one of our newsletters, we'll be glad to send you one free of charge. Give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, because our children are under attack today. And this is a terrible, terrible tragedy. We'll be back again, of course, tomorrow evening at the same time. Until then, may the Lord be with you. Remember our number, 1-800-544-8927. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. We welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Please, you can give us a call now. If you have a question or comment, our guest this evening is Dr. Mark Geyer or David Geyer, his son, and they, of course, a father-son team. They're working on many of these issues. Dr. Mark Geyer has both a PhD and an MD, and his son is just working on his degrees now, but he's helping, you know, do these extensive scientific studies, and, of course, they're getting right down to the very basis of this issue. And, of course, this is one of the great tragedies of modern time, and the fact that you're not reading about this every day in the media simply is a reflection of the degree of control that today exists over what the American people think. And if you read these articles in the New York Times, they're saying why there's no evidence there's any relationship between autism and thimerosal or vaccinations, or, you know, we've done this study, we've done that study, or this expert says this, or... And these are all contrived articles because the last thing they want is the American people to know the truth about this or so many other issues. And, of course, we see the tragedy of President Reagan today with Alzheimer's disease. And yet there seems to be very little doubt that there's a definite causal relationship between Alzheimer's disease and the histological changes there, which have been produced, and the analysis could only have been produced by mercury. And then the massive mercury exposure we have from mercury fillings, which have been put in to the mouths of Americans for almost 100 years, and it really didn't matter 50 years ago because most people didn't live much over 50, 55 years of age. But now with the people living longer and longer and longer times, more time for exposure. And then, of course, some people, I'm sure, do have the genetic predispositions, so they can't handle the mercury. And, of course, they become increasingly forgetful. And, of course, the American Dental Association has known about this for 100 years. 100 years ago, no ethical dentist would put mercury in your mouth. Today, why everybody does it, and the dentists are not at fault. The dentists simply are victims of this whole thing because they're getting tremendous mercury exposure when they put those fillings in, and they're being reassured over and over and over again by the Dental Association that there's nothing to worry about, even though the Dental Association and its lawyers know that, of course, they too are fighting a losing battle. Have you gotten at all into the issue of Alzheimer's disease and dental fillings?
Yes, we're involved in that. In fact, dental fillings seem to also be related to autism. That is, there's a tendency of children with autism to have mothers who had a lot of dental fillings, especially dental fillings during the pregnancy. There seems to be an association, and again, it makes sense.
Now, right now, of course, when you did this study on, of course, mercury excretion from autistic children, what part did the dental fillings in the children play in the part, or do these children have dental fillings?
In order to make that study pure, we excluded any children with dental fillings, because we wanted to just study, you know, external mercury sources. But the autistic clinics are finding various reports, and in fact, Dr. Haley's paper reports that children who end up in the autistic clinics tend to have mothers who are Rh negative, who got Rogam shots that contain thimerosal, and they also tended to have mothers that had a lot of dental fillings, especially fillings during the pregnancy. Women probably should not allow their teeth to be filled during the pregnancy, and probably none of us should have mercury fillings. And that brings up an interesting point, because a lot of us have. I happen to be lucky. I've never had a filling. But my wife has a mouthful of dental fillings, and she would like to get rid of them, but it's not so simple. Getting rid of them may cause more harm than good. If you take what they typically do to replace a filling is they drill it out. If you take a dental amalgam that's full of mercury and you put a drill in it, it's going to spray the mercury all over your mouth and the dentist as well. And that's going to be even worse than having it, you know, stay in there. There are a few dentists, I understand, that are now learning to take them out with a vacuum extractor so the mercury doesn't go anywhere. But, you know the story about the child that bit a mercury thermometer. And, I mean, they took him to the emergency room, they pumped his stomach. I mean, just picture the amount of mercury in an old mercury thermometer and the amount of mercury in a dental amalgam. And picture somebody taking a drill and going into it to try to get rid of it so they're going to replace it and spraying it all over your mouth. It's almost the same as breaking a mercury thermometer. So it could be very dangerous to remove them as well.
That's what he is. And it really is such a terrible tragedy because it was something that was totally unnecessary because, people had known for many years of the terrible toxic effects of mercury. That old expression, as mad as a hatter, and of course the reason that hatters went mad was because they used mercury when they made the hats. I don't know what it made them stiffer or what it was, but what happened in this town in Japan, what was that, Marimaka or something of the sort?
Marimata Bay, yeah.
Minamata
Bay. And then there's even beyond that, there's the example of Iraq. That's sort of the ultimate one. In Iraq, they were having yearly famines, so they were having trouble growing grain. So I think it was the United States and other countries supplied them with grain that was coated with mercury on it to prevent fungal contamination of the grain. The people got so hungry they started eating the grain that had the mercury on it. So you could do a grain-by-grain analysis of how much grain people ate and how much neurological problems they had. So the idea was they were supposed to use that for the seed stock. And if you sprayed it with mercury and prevented the seed stock from having fungus on it, and then you waited till the plant grew up and ate it, it was probably safe. But you weren't supposed to eat the grain that was the seed stock, but they were so hungry they actually ate the seed stock, and a whole bunch of them died or were damaged, and it led to very careful studies of how much mercury was safe. And
how long ago was that study? I'd never heard of that.
No, that's about 30 years ago.
About 30 years ago. So it's been known for a long time. And of course, we hear all this talk about, oh, you can't eat swordfish and you can't eat tuna. And if you're pregnant, you certainly shouldn't be eating these fishes that may be contaminated with mercury. And then they totally ignore the fact that, of course, you have mercury in your mouth. And, of course, that's constantly venting off fumes. But even more than that, there's Rogan. And that is given actually for RH incompatibility, isn't it?
Yeah, and that was a wonderful... See, a lot of these are wonderful success stories that were messed up. Before Rogan was invented, if a woman who was RH negative had a child who was RH positive, there was a good chance that the woman would make antibodies against the child's RH factor. And the mother's antibodies would attack the child's blood. And probably the first child would be okay, but if she had a second child, that child would really be sick. And if she had a third child, it would probably kill the child. And someone came up with a solution, which is called Rogam, which means that you make an antibody against the RH factor. And what they were doing is when the child was born, there's mixing between the mother's blood and the child's blood. So if the child was RH positive, they would give the mother a shot, and the mother would not make antibody, and she'd be fine for the second child. And that worked great. In fact, that got rid of 90% of the disorder. Unfortunately, 10% of the disorder continued. And the thought was there, well, the mixing wasn't at birth. It was sometime during the pregnancy. So if someone got a good idea, at least they thought it was a good idea, that at 28 weeks they would give a shot to protect it in case there was mixing during the pregnancy. And in fact, if someone did an amniocentesis, which is what I've done about 20,000 of, and they were RH negative, you give a shot then. And by the way, if she had bleeding or spotting, you give a shot then. And if she had a trauma to her abdomen, you give a shot then. And that actually got rid of the other 10%. Now there's almost no RH incompatibility disease. Unfortunately, Rogam contains large amounts of mercury. And pretty soon you're starting to give some of these women 4, 5, 6 shots, and they're getting an enormous dose. I mean, they're getting one shot is like 4 shots of vaccine. And if you get 5 shots like this, now you get 25 shots of vaccine. These are the same women that shouldn't eat one fish meal. And so many of the autism clinics are reporting that about 50% of the autistics are born to women who are RH negative. See, this didn't happen before because we were given it after the baby was born. And by the way, RH negative women only are about 8% of the population, but they're about 50% of the autistic mothers. So this is a tragedy again. Great technology, but bad preservative or bad mercury added. That was really a shame.
Well, of course, the thing is that, the doctors who were involved in this were trying to do the best that they could for the mothers and to prevent the children from having RH incompatibility. And at least, eventually they did begin to figure out what this was all about. Now, have they taken the mercury out of the RH, out of the Rogaine?
Well, first of all, I'm one of those doctors who gave it because I do amniocentesis. And I never realized there was mercury in it, and the reason was I was told mercury was only used when you have multi-dose vials. And there are no multi-dose vials of Rogaine, but again, unbeknownst to me, they were adding it to it for another reason. And then they announced that it's been out for years, and now once again we've heard an admission that it's probably out now, but it was in some of the products at least until the end of 2002. So we've been lied to again, and I hope it's out now, but I'm not certain of it.
Well, now, of course, you're doing amniocentesis. Are you? You're not a gynecologist, are you?
No, I'm a geneticist.
I have
an MD and my PhD is in genetics, and I do genetic counseling and high risk pregnancies and amniocentesis, and we give Rogaine shots. And so I'm one of those people that actually gave it, and it certainly was not my intent to cause damage to children. And anybody who uses these products, unless they're studying them full time, like we are now with vaccines, they have to rely on the FDA, the CDC, and the drug companies to, tell us what to do. And if they tell us wrong, we're totally helpless. There's no way that a doctor who isn't studying this can put enough time to understand what's going on.
And I know so much of what we do is simply done routinely. This is the way it's done. This is what you've been taught. And this is the way it's going to be done. And, of course, the difficulty is that somebody had to know. Now, whether this was just stupidity on the part of the people who were making this, or they wanted completely to ignore the dangers of thimerosal, we may never know. That's the tragedy of this whole thing. But once it became increasingly obvious there was a relationship between the Rogaine and autism, did they immediately stop using it or taking the thimerosal out of it?
No, there was no recall, and again, there was shelf life, and again, it's not clear. But what is clear is they did not, send out a notice, stop immediately, return all the Rogaine, we'll make you new Rogaine. They've never taken that kind of action, and of course, if they do that, they're afraid that that's going to cause them more litigation problems. So what their position is, the United States' position is, it's possible that it's causing this problem. But we're not certain, and we're going to remove it, not because it's causing it, but because we want to be extra safe, and it's fine to use up the current stocks, and it's fine to remove it slowly. And that's just not acceptable.
No, it really isn't. In fact, the one thing you learn in medical school is first do no harm. You may not do a lot of good, but don't do any harm to people. And I'm sure that the doctors would never willingly do harm to their people, patients. But, the drug companies have a different motivation, and that is the unfortunate part of this. I think if there is any question that it might even be harmful, they should stop it immediately and then, of course, not release it again until such time as, they are absolutely certain. Otherwise, why, of course, every person who has an autistic child, has, in my estimation, a legitimate claim against that drug company.
Well, and worse than that, we haven't talked about is what the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention has done about thimerosal.
Well, tell us what the CDC has done.
Well, the story of the CDC and thimerosal dates back to their original studies were done in 1999. And they analyzed something called the Vaccine Safety Data Link. This is at the time was a private database that the CDC only had access to. It was made up of data generated from California Kaisers and from some other HMOs in the Pacific Northwest. And what they did was look to see the amount of thimerosal children received and to see how many neurodevelopmental disorders they had in comparison to children that received less thimerosal. And they showed, if you look, there was a tremendously increased risk of these neurodevelopmental disorders that followed a dose-response relationship with the amount of mercury. That means that as the amount of mercury that went up, the children received from these vaccines, so did the risk of these neurodevelopmental disorders. And they did their initial study on about 120,000 children in a California Kaiser, and they found these dose-response effects for neurodevelopmental disorders. Then they went and did a second study in a much smaller population that was only about 20,000 children. And again, they could only they saw the exact same effect as they saw with the other HMO. And then they went and did their third study. In their third study, they went to an HMO called Harvard Pilgrim. And this HMO is in the state of Massachusetts. And there they looked at about 17,000 children, and they could only look at two outcomes, and they didn't see any relationship between mercury and risk of neurodevelopmental disorders. And they went and presented this information to the Institute of Medicine when they held hearings in 2001 about the relationship between thimerosal and neurodevelopmental disorders. And the IOM concluded that it was biologically plausible that thimerosal could cause neurodevelopmental disorders, but the epidemiological evidence was mixed, and the evidence they were referring to came from the CDC. And as it turns out, we've now got information about, if you look around in various parts of the country or in each state, the U.S. Department of Education has the amount of increase in autism broken down by each state during the time period that the CDC did their study. And what you find is every state in the country, except for one, had more than 100% increase in autism.
Want to guess which one?
Which Massachusetts.
You got it.
Yeah. Massachusetts only had a 10% increase during that time.
Now, why would that be?
And that was because of a reporting glitch. If you look in more current Department of Education breakdowns, it's now gone up like the national average. It says 400, 500, 600% increase, which is what the nation had at that time. And it was only a temporary glitch that allowed them to be able to find no effect in Massachusetts.
And they didn't tell the IOM that Massachusetts was the only state that didn't have it. They said they found it in two places, didn't find it in the other, see, it's mixed.
And in actuality, it really proved it. They had positive controls. Where there was an increase, they found the effect. And where there was no, you know, where there was no increase, they didn't find it. So it actually validates their methodology. In addition, we're actually in the process of trying to get access to this CDC database. And what we found is that the CDC has only gone to Harvard Pilgrim one time for data, for the vaccine safety data link. And it's only for this thimerosal study. They've never requested any other data from Harvard Pilgrim.
And also, the person doing the study was named Dr. Verstappen, and Burton's committee, the congressional committee, would like to question him on this issue. But unfortunately, as he presented those three studies, two positive and one negative, he pointed out he no longer works for the government for 2 hours. He'd already been employed and left the country and now works in
Belgium for GlaxoSmithKline.
And won't come back to testify, by the way.
Now, of course, who is GlaxoSmithKline and what do they produce?
They're a vaccine manufacturer. And, of course, even worse than that, the most recent is that he's now publishing from GlaxoSmithKline in Belgium with the CDC studies about vaccine safety still.
And this is a guy who won't come back and testify, and this is a guy who obviously fooled the IOM into saying that the statistics was made. See, they don't want to fool them so much that they think it isn't true, because then they might not take the thimerosal out. What they want to do is they want to do exactly what the lady from the FDA who got up after my testimony said. I gave testimony, and this was much earlier. We didn't have as much data as we do now, that we thought it was probably the thimerosal that was causing a lot of the autism. And Congressman Burton got up, and he had invited, since he's Government Oversight Committee, you know, representatives from all areas of the government, and he said, somebody, please get up and say that Dr. Geyer is wrong. And nobody would do it. Finally, a lady from the FDA got up, and she said, well, we don't know. He might be right, and he might be wrong. At which point, Burton went ballistic. I mean, he started banging on it. You mean you might be poisoning these children, and you're still doing it, you know? And then she, of course, went on and said that it was all out of the vaccines, which is, of course, perjury, because she knew it was still in the vaccines. But there's an obvious cover-up that's going on, and there's an obvious relationship between the CDC and the companies that they're supposed to be regulating. The next thing she said was, Dr. Geyer said they could take the thimerosal out if they went to single-dose vials. This is when I thought it was actually a preservative, and it wasn't necessary in single-dose vials. And she says, you know, that's going to cost the companies more money. Well, you know, she doesn't work for the company. I found that an unbelievable statement for someone for the FDA to say. It's not even her business. I mean, first of all, it's pennies, but that's beside the point. You know, if you owned a restaurant and you needed a smoke detector, they'd come in and they'd say, you need a smoke detector. They wouldn't say it's going to cost you more money. She was acting like she worked for the drug companies. If they got up and said it would cost them more money, well, I would say too bad, but I'd listen to them. But for the FDA to say, well, we can't ask them to do that. It would cost them more money. I mean, it's like they work for the FDA works for the drug companies. And my understanding is you and I, as taxpayers, we hire these people to protect us from the drug companies. And instead, they're working with the drug companies.
Well, you know, the tragedy is that many of the people who work for the FDA, when they leave the Federal Drug Administration, go to work for the very companies that they've been regulating. And I know that to be a fact from talking to other people in other fields. So there is certainly an incest. In fact, much of what goes on makes incest a bad name. Have you run into that?
Oh, yeah. Unfortunately, it's even much worse than that. That's what used to happen, and that's terrible and awful. It turns out that the CDC has even worse connections. There's something called the CDC Foundation. And this is something anybody in the entire world can simply go on the World Wide Web and search, and you'll find a site called the CDC Foundation. And at this foundation site, what they say is they sponsor research of individual scientists at the CDC, and you look to see who funds the CDC Foundation, and this is available online. It's people like Wyeth Vaccine Division, Merck Vaccine Division, and there's Eli Lilly funds. All the major pharmaceuticals out there fund individual workers at the CDC through the CDC Foundation. And as Burton saw in his hearings and he's put out in his report, vaccines are controlled by these committees. They vote on how they should use vaccines. And in each case that he's looked into, the people voting on how the vaccine should be used, over half of them either own a patent, take money directly from the company, own stock in the company, or in some way, in a major, and he knew how many shares, by the way, and everything, in a major way is associated with the vaccine. And obviously, these people need to be independent because they're deciding on how the very substance that they're making money on is to be used. This cannot occur, and as long as that occurs, we're going to continue to have catastrophes with a wonderful piece of technology being used by people who have a vested interest.
Well, you know, it's sort of like, and it's a little off the subject, but there's an ad that's running on television now. It says Zocar. You know, it's a cholesterol drug. Ask your doctor about Zocar. And it says, you know, we have this wonderful study, and it came out of, I think, the Harvard or Oxford or something like that. And, you know, a study for 5 years, partly funded by Merck Company. And, boy, it says that this product is really what you need to have. And, of course, everybody can't take it because it can poison your liver and poison this and that and the other thing. And, you know, you wouldn't want to take it if you're pregnant. But, you know, this is what you ought to be taking. And they just very casually mentioned partly funded by the Merck Company. Well, does anybody think that a study that is funded by Merck is not going to come up with a result that's favorable to Merck? And
you know,
of course, this is carried right over into everything. In fact, my doctor wants me to take some cholesterol medication because in the past a cholesterol of 230 was perfectly normal, and now they've decided that if it's over 200, it's abnormal, and so you've got to take their product. And these people have convinced the doctors we all ought to be on cholesterol medicine. And yet they're the ones who are selling the cholesterol medicine.
It's so bad that there's a recent article in the JAMA, Journals of the AMA. And by the way, that journal has about 25 pages of drug advertising. So they're actually funded by the drug company. But they still published this study. And the study showed, and it was very neatly done with statistics, and it's a very long study, it showed that studies that are funded by industry are 4 times more likely to come up with positive results for the industry than studies that aren't funded by industry. And another interesting study that was just published in Nature, which is probably the world's leading journal, was a study by the ex-president of Harvard Medical School, who did a survey, and he surveyed scientists who had taken money from the tobacco industry and asked them if they thought secondary smoke caused harm. 94% of them said no. He then surveyed scientists who didn't take tobacco company money and asked them if they thought that secondary smoke caused harm, and 83% of them said yes. There's a real problem. Even JAMA recognizes that science is no longer unbiased.
And yet, Chris, the whole idea of science is knowledge. We want to get to the truth. And unfortunately, it seems to have a price tag on it. And of course, it's no longer science. It's propaganda and hiding behind science. And that's why I appreciate so much the work that you're doing, because you're doing trying to find out what's really going on, and then, of course, getting the information out to the American people.
And you know, the CDC, FDA, and HHS, by the way, that's all one organization. HHS runs CDC and FDA. They know exactly what we know. They know it was caused by thimerosal. And let me explain to you why I know this. I mean, they know there's a big epidemic of autism. They know that there's billions or trillions of dollars of damage. Okay? Now, there are three possibilities. I've thought about this for a long time. There are three possibilities. One possibility is they're so stupid that they're not going to do anything. And they're not stupid. They have lots of talent, lots of smart people, people smarter than me. The second thing is that they don't care that the United States may fall as a government because, you know, we have so many people damaged that we can't run the place. And although, you know, sometimes they get angry at them, I don't believe that that's true either. I don't believe they'd let the United States intentionally fall. And the third possibility is they know the reason for this problem, and they've already begun to correct it. And that's the answer. And I can think of no other answer. And if they weren't sure that we're right, that's the thimerosal, they would be outspending the full force of the United States research to try to find an alternate. Let's say, for example, it was a pollutant. Let's say it was a terrorist putting it in our children's water. They would be out there spending tons of money. Now, they're out there spending money. They're spending money on SARS, of which I think there was one case in the United States. They're out there spending big money on monkeypox, of which there were 8 cases. And I'm not saying they shouldn't spend that money, but here's a disease that's obviously threatening our very existence, and they're not spending any money at all on it. They must know the answer, and they must know they're already taking steps to correct it. It has to be that they know the thimerosal is causing it, and they have to know it even more certainly than we do. There's no other possible explanation.
And that's why you think that they're taking it out of the, getting it out of the vaccines.
Yes, but slowly.
And interestingly, might say, if we ever seen a decrease in the amount of autism, and believe it or not, actually we're starting to see a decrease. It turns out that in the mid-1990s, while nobody was actually trying to remove the thimerosal from the vaccines, they were developed combination vaccines. The specific thing that happened was there were two vaccines called DPT and HIP, which is Haemophilus influenza type B. And they were initially given separately, and then they were combined in the mid-1990s, which resulted in about 125 microgram reduction in the amount of thimerosal children were exposed to. And when that happened, total amount of mercury per child went down, and we've seen a decrease in the prevalence of autism during that time. So the initial pattern looks like you see in the 1980s to the late 1980s, it skyrocketed up into the early 1990s, and it peaked. And then beginning by about the mid-1990s, it started going down as the amount of mercury went down. And the sad thing is, it's only a temporary downward trend. Again, towards the late 1990s, the amount of thimerosal went back up because instead of giving DPT, they started giving DTAP. And when they did that, they could no longer give the HIB vaccine with that one. So they actually separated them, and the amount of mercury went back up. And we believe that the amount of number of cases of autism will go back up.
Then it'll start coming down again.
And we've actually submitted that for publication, and we saw a decrease.
You actually went through the VAERS reports, didn't you? These reports were sent in of adverse reactions?
Several different sources.
What I was going to say is what I'm describing is from the U.S. Department of Education. This is just total number of autistics in a given year and the mercury burden within that given year.
All right.
So that was one source. And we also analyzed something called the Vaccine Adverse Events Reporting System, or VAERS database. In that database, we looked at there are some vaccines that are thimerosal-containing and some that are thimerosal-free, and they're given to the exact same children, the exact same schedule. And we looked to see whether, if you got the thimerosal-free one, you had a reduced risk of these various neurodevelopmental disorders. And we saw that that was true. And then, of course, we looked at the Vaccine Safety Data Link studies from the CDC, and they show these dose-response effects for thimerosal and neurodevelopmental disorders. So we're pretty sure that there's a very strong relationship between thimerosal and neurodevelopmental disorders.
All right, we're going to be back here in just a moment or two. We'll welcome your calls at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and of course our guest this evening is Dr. Mark Geyer and his son David Geyer, and we're of course talking about we've been talking about all sorts of things, dealing with, of course, the vaccines and this epidemic of autism, which really threatens in many ways the stability of our nation. Fortunately, why it would appear that they're taking the thimerosal out of the vaccines, little bit by little bit, and of course it's Dr. Geyer's contention that they don't want to take it out all at once, because if they did, and suddenly there was a dramatic drop in the incidence of autism, why then of course there'd be no question that the liability here would just be staggering. And the feeling is, and I really believe that this is one of the major motivating forces, is they do not want to do anything that would let the people realize that there have been some serious errors made in giving vaccines, because they're afraid people will lose confidence in vaccines. Now, vaccines have done wonderful things, doing away with smallpox, doing away with polio, dramatic incidence, decrease in incidence of other diseases is great. But, of course, there have been some terrible, terrible problems with vaccines as well, because they haven't been thoroughly studied, they haven't been carefully analyzed. And, of course, rather than admit that and let the public realize, of course, that you really cannot necessarily depend upon either the manufacturers or government, they're simply lying and covering up, as they did with the original polio vaccine and the fact that there was a cancer-producing virus, an SV40 in that, that they gave to 90 million Americans. And, of course, the same thing would hold true as far as the next polio vaccine, the Sabin vaccine, and that had the monkey cytomegalic viruses in it. And, of course, because they were growing these various vaccines in the kidneys of various species of monkeys, the first in rhesus monkeys, the second in green monkeys, without ever bothering to find out what other vaccines they were going to give us. And don't you think that maybe what they've done is they've got themselves in such a situation and they're just afraid to say, look, we made a mistake, we'll try to do better next time?
Yeah, I think that's what they should do, but I don't think that they in the past have done that, and I don't think they're likely to do it in the future. An interesting thing about the vaccines that we haven't mentioned so far is that we talked about mercury being given, and we talked about the Iraq studies that showed how much mercury you can take safely. Well, the EPA has a maximum amount of mercury that they think is safe, and that is 0.1 micrograms per kilogram per day. And this is a very easy thing to apply. If you look at a newborn weighs about 3.3 kilos, so 0.1 microgram per kilo is 0.3 micrograms they're allowed per day safely. And so, as you mentioned, on the first day of life, they gave them a hepatitis B shot, 12.5 micrograms. It's 39 times over their own limits, by the way. And then you look at 2 months and 4 months and 6 months, and they're actually hundreds of times over their own safety limits. Now, they would say that the safety limits I just gave you were for methyl mercury, and this is ethyl mercury. Actually, the safety limits I gave you were for daily methyl mercury. And so they try to say ethyl mercury is much safer than methyl mercury. Unfortunately, there are numerous studies that show that ethyl mercury and methyl mercury are handled similarly. In fact, if anything, ethyl mercury is probably worse. So they've actually not only, been asleep at the switch, but they've violated their own guidelines, and not by a little bit, by a tremendous amount.
Well, do you think that there's tremendous pressure there not to do anything that would be embarrassing to the vaccine companies for fear that people would lose confidence in vaccines?
Yeah, and in fact, ever since I've been involved in vaccines, and when I first got involved, I was told, okay, you found a problem, don't tell anybody, because if you tell anybody, they'll get frightened, they won't take their vaccines, and they'll die, and it'll be my fault. And I bought the explanation originally, but I've been around 25 years, and I found out that if you don't tell anybody, they don't fix it. And the truth of the matter is, there's a fair amount of lack of confidence in vaccines right now. And it's not because David and Mark Geyer go around telling people about the problem. The problem is that they have made numerous mistakes in vaccines. And I believe that there's a good chance they made the mistakes because of conflict of interest. And let me give you a few examples of the mistakes. You've already given some. You talked about the SV40 and the polio vaccine, but let's talk about a few other minor little faux pas that they made. For example, there's a vaccine called rotavirus. Rotavirus caused diarrhea in young children in the United States and worldwide. there's very few deaths from diarrhea in the United States. There are a lot of deaths in the third world country. They came out with a vaccine, which if you look at their safety data, didn't look very good. In fact, it looked terrible. But they approved it anyway. 9 months later, they had to withdraw the vaccine because the children developed intussusception, which means the intestine started sliding into itself like a telescope. A number of children died, a number of children had emergency surgery. So a little faux pas there, they made a mistake on that one. Then let's see, there was Lyme vaccine. You know, I'm sitting here in Maryland, the Lyme capital of the world, next to Connecticut, I guess. Lyme disease is caused by a bite from a tick. It's not very nice to get. Everybody wanted a vaccine for it. They brought this committee together, which again had a conflict of interest. They reviewed the Lyme data, and it looked terrible to me as I looked at it backward, you know, in retrospect. But they approved the Lyme vaccine. Let's see, 2 years later, they had to remove the Lyme vaccine because they had problems. Let's talk about whole cell DPT. That's a vaccine that we've known causes problems since the 30s or before. We've known how to make a better vaccine since the 60s. The Japanese made a much better vaccine since 1981. It took us 20 years to convert. And by the way, we converted by buying the Japanese vaccine. So there are a few, and there are numerous other examples that you could go into. They have not made the right decision. Oh, the polio one is an interesting one. When we first got polio, in addition to the problems you mentioned, we used to get killed polio. And there was an incident where they forgot to kill it right, but other than that, killed polio was probably the right decision. We then switched to live polio vaccine, which caused a lot of the problems you mentioned. And by the way, guess what happened now? We finally admitted it. We've gone back to killed polio. So we made the wrong decision there, although there's an interesting thing in Africa. They give live polio vaccine. And you can't give live polio vaccine to people who are immunodepressed. And Africa has a ton of AIDS. And those people who have AIDS have a high risk of developing paralytic polio from the vaccine. But anyway, they go on and give it. So that's another example of a mismanaged group. So when you look back, it looks like they've made a lot of wrong decisions. And they would say, well, you know, it's hindsight. Dr. Geyer is looking backwards. It's easy to make the right decisions. But, you know, when they make so many wrong decisions, and they also have a conflict of interest, that is, they own part of the vaccine they're deciding on, or they get paid by the companies, or they're funded by the companies, or whatever, it doesn't look good. It looks like those decisions were not made without conflict of interest.
I agree with you totally, and I think that this is why I do programs like this. You know, as far as trying to make parents aware, and I think that certain vaccines are important. I think that other vaccines, like the hepatitis B vaccine for infants, I think is, in my estimation, totally uncalled for, unless, of course, mother has hepatitis B, which, as you pointed out, would be maybe 1 in 1,000 mothers. So they are simply, because 1 in 1,000 children might have a problem, they're going to give it to everybody, and then, of course, it has the mercury in it, and then we get all the complications. Well, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-8295. If you're out there across America listening to us, or here in the Central Coast of California, give us a call if you have a question for a Mark or a David Geyer, because they certainly are on the front lines of this battle, trying to, of course, bring out the truth about really what's going on, and of course, trying to force the companies to get the thimerosal out of their products, and of course, stop this terrible, terrible plague of autism, which, as they point out, threatens in many respects the very survival of our nation. Because when you start having literally millions of autistic children going on to the Social Security rolls, what do you think is going to happen to the Social Security system of our nation? And of course, these are people who, under ordinary circumstances, be working and be productive. Instead, of course, they're going to be getting welfare. And of course, it's going to be extremely expensive to take care of these people who are victims of a vaccine program really gone mad. So, you know, as you talk to people about this, I'm sure you've talked to Congressman Burton and others, what sort of response are you getting from them?
Well, we get strong support from Burton, who's extremely angry, who's more, you know, more vocal than I am, and who goes around saying that, you know, these people should not only be stopped, they should be in jail. In fact, I think he may be doing a criminal investigation. On the other hand, there are other people in government who, if you talk to them, the first thing they do is they go pick up the phone and they call the CDC. And the CDC says, what problem? We don't know of any problem. These people, you know, they just go, they might be right, but we're not sure. And they, you know, I can understand why somebody might tend to, if they didn't know the issue very well, might tend to rely on our government experts. I would have too if I didn't know what I know.
Well, and of course, one of the things that's happening is that more and more parents are really saying, we're not going to give our children any vaccines, which I think is a mistake as well. So somewhere in there, there's a sort of a happy medium between what we should be doing and what we are doing. How do you feel about giving children the killed polio vaccine? Do you think that the Salk vaccine is worthwhile taking?
The killed polio vaccine is excellent. It has, other than, you know, if somebody forgets to kill it or something, I mean, a mistake can be made by anybody. But other than that, that's a vaccine. That's the one that should be given. That one has virtually wiped out a dread disease and has very few side effects.
All right, now how about MMR? Can we be sure that the children are not going to get this measles infection, this attenuated measles infection?
MMR worries me more, but I still think that probably the vaccine, when used intelligently, has more benefit than risk.
No.
What I mean by intelligently is that you got to give it to the right people. For example, I work with OBGYN. In fact, my training is OBGYN. As I mentioned, I do amniocentesis. If a woman who is has a baby is rubella negative, after she has the baby, the standard of care is to offer her a rubella vaccine so that she's not at risk to have rubella syndrome in her next pregnancy. That makes sense. All of a sudden, rubella vaccine is virtually impossible to get. They make you give MMR. Now, she has no reason to take the mumps or the measles vaccine or the risk from those. So it's not an intelligent use of the vaccine to give MMR to 30-year-old women considering pregnancy who are rubella negative. They need rubella vaccine. Also, it doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me to give rubella vaccine to a 21-year-old male college student who is not going to have any babies because the males don't have babies. Now, he may need a measles shot if he's not immune to measles, but why give him the whole MMR? Also, it would be more intelligent probably to give the MMR separately as an option because they seem to be more dangerous when given together. And that's a vaccine, I think, that the solution, ultimate solution, is to make a killed MMR vaccine. And there was a killed MMR vaccine in the past, which was much safer, but it had a problem. It was missing a particular protein. We now know which protein. I think we would be capable of making a killed MMR vaccine that would protect everybody and would have virtually no side effects. So I think that's the future of MMR shots.
Well, now, one of the things is whenever you go to the hospital, why, of course, they're going to, and you have a cut, why they're going to give you the toxoid if you haven't had a tetanus toxoid in a matter of 5 or 10 years. But when you go in, they not only want to give you the toxoid, they want to give you a diphtheria shot along with it. How do you feel about a DT vaccines for, if you have a cut?
I think it should be tetanus toxoid.
Right, I do too, and that's what we used to do. But in recent years, of course, well, all we have is the DT, so that's what you're going to have to take it, that or nothing, and this is a standard of practice. And I think you're absolutely right. This is organized madness. I mean, why take a diphtheria shot when, of course, you're really trying to prevent tetanus?
I agree with you. I think that the vaccines need to be for what they really need to be for, and this combination of getting more and more people to take more when it's unnecessary doesn't make sense. On the other hand, as I said, I think the killed polio vaccine is fine. I think the acellular DTAP without thimerosal is worth taking because, each of those three diseases, diphtheria, tetanus, and pertussis are all very bad diseases. They need to be given in the first year of life because pertussis is particularly bad on young infants. But, of course, they should be given with acellular vaccine, which fortunately now is what we make in the United States, and it has to be thimerosal-free. And in future years, as soon as possible, we need to remove any adjuvants. The aluminum adjuvants increase the rate of autoimmune disease because they make the body make an immune response that's non-specific. And they use primarily because the companies are too cheap to put enough antigen in. What you'd like to do is make enough antigen that you don't need an adjuvant.
All right, fine. Well, let's go to Nathan's calling from Contra Costa. Nathan, you have a question or comment?
Yes. There's a particularly disturbing story out there about some parents who attempted to look in, whose doctor wanted their child to have chemotherapy, and the parents attempted to get a second opinion and were arrested.
Now, chemotherapy, that's a sort of this is for cancer or something?
Yes. They attempted to exercise custody of their own children and not do it. It was referred to as kidnapping, And now these parents are up on trial for kidnapping. For attempting to get a second opinion.
Well, I think it's a little different subject, but I share your concern. This idea that I'm sure it's the children belong to the state and the doctors know what's best, and trying to get a second opinion, I think that's a ridiculous situation. I think a doctor should encourage second opinions, certainly not discourage them.
Well, I mean, I always thought of a second or third opinion as a you know, human right.
Right. Well, it would be, and I don't know anything at all about that. Maybe you can get some information on that case.
Well, please look into it. It's been in the New York Times. It's not secret.
All right, fine. I'll see if I can track it down.
Take care.
Thank you so much, Nathan. All right, fine. That's Nathan calling from Contra Costa County. If you're out there and you have another question, our telephone number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. And I've read the New York Times. I haven't seen any mention of that case, but maybe I can find some mention of it somewhere along the line. Now, of course, are there any other vaccines you think are really important? What about the Haemophilus influenza vaccine that they're pushing so hard now?
It's a very important vaccine as well. Haemophilus influenza caused nasty bacteria, you know, meningitis in some children. It is a vaccine worth taking.
All right.
It's one that's very hard for us to study, because it's always given with DPT, and so we really can't say what the adverse events are that really are associated with it, but we think it's worth taking. And another one given at the same time is also Prevnar, which is a pneumococcal pneumonia vaccine.
What do you think of that one?
Again, it's given, the problem is all of these are given with DPT vaccine, so it's very hard to study their safety profiles. And even in we have some objection that even in the safety trials, when these vaccines went, you know, to be licensed, they were given with whole cell DPT, so it was very hard to see any additional reactions that these vaccines were causing.
All right, let's go to.
But you know, we think it should be given until proven that, because it clearly has benefit, but we would love to see them given separately so that it wouldn't cause any great harm if they were given a couple weeks after the DPT, at least in some children, so that we could see what the reactions are due to those vaccines.
All right, let's go to Roy calling from Santa Cruz. Hi, Roy. How are you doing?
Hi, Dr. Stan. Pretty well. I enjoy your show, and I just had a question about the mercury in the teeth.
Yes,
Well, I ran it by my dentist, and I went to a dentist in Belgium, and I said I was a little concerned about the mercury in the fillings. And he told me everything was silver nowadays, and it hadn't been mercury since the 60s.
Where does he practice?
In Belgium, in Antwerp.
Well, maybe practices in Belgium, but over here in this country, why are they still putting mercury in? And they're standard almost 50% mercury. Isn't that right, Dr. Geyer?
It's probably 80%. And in many European countries, it's true, have gotten rid of it for many, many years and consider our use of mercury archaic and barbaric. And yet the United States primarily uses mercury fillings.
I think that may be the answer to your question, that in Europe, they know how. In fact, in Europe, they don't fluoridate the water. Over here, we fluoridate the water. In Europe, they don't use mercury fillings. Over here, we do.
Exactly. Okay, well, that was just I just assumed that we were following the European plan here, and I thought we were ahead of the time here, but maybe we're not.
We're so far behind the plan. This is the problem, and you're given this idea that, oh, we've got all this wonderful science, we can put a man on the moon, and something as simple as mercury fillings, when they've known, they knew 100 years ago that mercury fillings were dangerous, and so it was basically considered immoral or wrong or unethical to put in a mercury filling. So the people who wanted to use them formed the American Dental Association, and that's how the ADA got formed, and they've been pushing it ever since then. But they're in real trouble because of the Internet and because of programs like this and people like Dr. Boyd Haley. If you haven't heard my interviews with him, you really need to get it or get this wonderful video we have now. It's called Uninformed Consent. It really is excellent.
Okay, well, thanks, Dr. Stan. Yeah. I was just really surprised that the same thing that we were doing this still with the mercury in our fillings here, and I thought I could just rely on the information from Europe, and it doesn't apply to America.
You're absolutely right. They've got better. I mean, on this instance, they're absolutely right.
Okay, well, thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Have a good evening.
Okay, fine.
And interestingly, I hear that the NIH has now agreed to open hearings on that issue, and Boyd Haley is going to be invited, which means probably that they're not going to get away with covering it up.
Well, I think that this is really, there's tremendous pressure out there, and more people are becoming aware of this. I mean, I really didn't give this much of a thought until a couple of years ago, and of course, my dentist had gotten into discussing this and studying it and gave me some material on it, and then, of course, after talking to Boyd Haley and Christy Diamond and some of the others, you suddenly realize what a terrible problem it is. Now, I think I've got almost all of my mercury fillings out. I've got gold caps on most of the teeth, but certainly for the people who do not have them and are having any problems at all, I certainly recommend this, especially as we see this epidemic of Alzheimer's disease, this incapacitating more and more of our older patients.
Did you see the article in the New England Journal several months ago on mercury and heart attack?
No, I didn't know. What was that about?
They studied, you know, there's this thought that fish oil might prevent some heart attacks. And they did a study and they found that fish oil actually might help prevent some heart attacks, but the mercury in the fish is increasing the heart attack rate. And I wonder if the mercury in the fillings might also increase the heart attack rate.
Well, one of the things I wanted to ask you is, what about these children? You, of course, were able to, in the study that you had given me, a case control study of mercury burden in children with autism, and, of course, you were able to get them to excrete the mercury. Is this in any way reversible? Is there any way you can actually get them to unload a lot of this mercury out of their brains? And is this in any way reversible?
The chelation clearly can remove mercury. The question is, does that removal of the mercury improve the children? And you might notice, since you read that paper that we sent you, we made no such claim. And the reason is that is a very, you know, before you claim that, you really have to do a very careful study on it. We've proven that they have mercury. We've proven that you can remove the mercury. In order to really tell, and I mean, there are lots of parents getting this treatment, and there are lots of anecdotal stories of the children getting better. There are also anecdotal stories of the children not getting better. We think that a study needs to be done where children have a PET or a SPECT scan of their brain to see how much damage there is. Then they have the mercury removed, and then they have to demonstrate that the brain got better to demonstrate that it works. And I don't know if it'll work, because it could very well be that the mercury caused permanent damage and the brain is too late. I don't know. But I think that is at least a rational idea of therapy. If you have too much mercury, it might help to remove it.
Well, now, of course, we've heard for years that some of the various diets that autistic children are put onto would be beneficial. Have you looked into that aspect of it at all?
Since I go to a number of these conferences and Dave and I make presentations, we've heard a lot of that. And I don't know whether it's true or not. And as a traditional physician who, you know, worked at NIH and was a professor at Hopkins, these things sound a little bit far out to me. But my suggestion to anybody who thinks that they have a treatment that really helps autism is to do what I said. Scan the children before the treatment, show the amount of brain damage. Do your treatment, scan them again, and show me that the brain damage got better. Anecdotal stories that the parents think it's better, that may just mean that, you know, you're paying attention to the children. You really need to have something like a scan.
No, tell me about, because, you know, I'd never heard of these SPECT scans. They didn't have those when I quit medicine, a decade ago. How do these work, and, of course, what are they actually going to be able to pick up?
If you do autistic children and you scan them with a CT scan or an MRI scan, which looks at the structure of the brain, you'll find in general they're normal.
Right.
However, the problem is the brains don't function very well. And the PETs and the SPECTs work by giving the children a radioactive glucose precursor. And since the brain uses glucose as its carbon source, the parts of the brain that are working take up the glucose, and you can scan them. And you can see areas that where there's damage to the cells and they don't take up the glucose. And so this is a metabolic scan. And in fact, if you're really clever, you can do dual isotope in something called a DTEC scan, where you put in another radioisotope that actually stays within the blood vessels. And so you can see the amount of blood supply and the amount of metabolism. And what you're looking for is damaged areas have normal blood supply but abnormal metabolism. And the machine actually gives you a percent. So you can say that, you know, there's 83% function in this part of the brain, 25% function in this part of the brain. And the idea would be to scan them first and then treat them. And if you had a, you know, for example, an area of the brain that said that was 25%, and after you do whatever treatment you want, whether it's chelation or vitamin therapy, whatever you think works, if you can change that 25% to 80%, you've convinced me, and you'll convince a lot of people in the medical world, rather than just saying, well, the kid looks a little better.
Well, of course, there are all sorts of opportunities out there for people who have the time and the patience and the ability to do the studies. But the biggest thing would be the funding. And is there any funding available through NIH or certainly CDC or any of the foundations for this?
The NIH, in my opinion, will never fund such a study because that study would be funding the end of a lot of their careers. They do a small amount of studies on the genetics of autism, and there's some genetics. That is, you can find markers of susceptibility on various chromosomes. But I do not believe the NIH, since they are heavily involved with, the, you know, they're under auspices of the HHS and CDC and FDA are all interrelated. I don't think they're going to fund that. And I think if a worker at the NIH did that study and found that, I think they would end up like Andy Wakefield. I think we've got to find outside funding, and we are looking into that. We have to find private funding. Because they have a vested interest, they can't find that answer.
Well, I think it's there's so many great horizons over there, so many things that could be done, and if you could help even a small portion of these children, it would be such a great humanitarian act. And I really applaud you, both of you, for the work you're doing and for your effort to try to get to the bottom of this and at least participating and putting the pressure on. And if they are gradually beginning to phase out the use of thimerosal, I mean, they should stop it immediately. But as you point out, if they stopped it immediately and the incidence of autism fell, why, of course, that could end their careers as well. And I would really wish we had people who were really more concerned with human suffering than with preserving their job and their income and, of course, their position within the government bureaucracy. Well, we're just about out of time. What thoughts would you like to leave with our listeners this evening?
I'd like the problem to be really solved, and the problem isn't just thimerosal. The problem is that we need to have some sort of system by which vaccines and probably other medicines as well are overseen by organizations that have no vested interest. And originally, the CDC, FDA, NIH had no vested interest because they weren't allowed to take outside funding, and now they are allowed to take outside funding. I think we need to have some sort of oversight committee of people who have never taken any funding, and they are the people that have to make the decisions of, you know, when we give the hepatitis B, when what things we put in the vaccine. That would not only cure the current problems, but the ones that are, you know, right around the corner in the future.
What do you think about the Royal Society in London? I've read some of their reports. They seem to be fairly objective. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I don't know them specifically, but I found the British government to be more hiding of what's happening than the American government.
Well, no, this has nothing to do with the government. It's the Royal Society of Medicine over there, which at least the reports I've read certainly are far different than the reports that I get out of the United States. Well, we'll have to solve the rest of these problems some other evening because we're out of time. David, do you have any parting thoughts for us? All right, fine. Well, God bless you. Thank both of you very much. It's been a marathon two-hour program, but I hope our listeners out there got a tremendous insight into what the problem is, and, they're going to be very, very wary. Not give up vaccines, but, of course, insist that the vaccines they're taking were as safe as they can possibly be. God bless you both. Thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Thank you for having us.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Okay, fine. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and this is the time I have to remind you, Radio Liberty is listener-supported. We ask you for your help. We ask you to consider joining the Radio Liberty family. We ask for your prayers for America, for revival, and specifically for Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. And so until tomorrow evening at the same time, we'll be back. Got some fascinating programs this week. Dr. Stan, good night, and may the Lord be with you.